Look, up in the air. It's a bird. It's a plane. It's We Got the Geek.
Hey, Geeksters. This is Jody, Ryan, and our new friend, John. And we've got something special for you today. So put away your usual superhero costumes and put on those kung fu geese, because this is We Got the Geek Martial Arts Edition.
So I'm a new friend now.
You're new to me.
The meatball is in the house. Here to talk kung fu.
Awesome. Yeah, you were supposed to be with us on the last one, but I think...
Yeah, scheduling conflicts couldn't make it, but you guys said Bruce Lee, so
actually,
I'm there.
Actually, Jody, he's right about that. As soon as I told him, he was like, yeah, I'm one in. Like, hardly finished that sentence, he's like, yeah, I want in.
Yeah, you mentioned Bruce Lee, and I'm here, man. Like, kung fu as it is. I'll get in on any of the martial arts stuff that I can.
Yeah, I saw him at work in the parking lot. Literally, he was jumping up and down as we were talking about it on his way to the car. I'm like, okay, man, like, we got to get you in on this. It's going to be exciting, so here he is.
Yeah, so who's Bruce Lee again?
Some dude.
Some guy that does
dude that things really well.
Chinese boxing, I think.
Something like that, yeah. He kicked people. Had a 1-inch punch, I think, right?
Yeah, 1-inch punch, yeah.
But he had to do it from, like, 10 feet away? Something like that? I don't know. I'm glad you guys got me in on this. I'm really excited. I have loved Bruce Lee movies since I was a kid. So, you know, it was really exciting to be able to get to review these again.
Yeah,
you know,
for sure.
I watch them all the time. So, give me another reason to watch Chuck Norris get his ass handed to him.
Yeah, we'll definitely be talking about that. So, first up, we're going to be talking about... one of the first films, The Big Boss, is the, I guess, Chinese version. It was also known as Fist of Fury, set in 1971. So that was the first one that he kind of did. You want to go into that?
Well, you are correct, though. Like, they did, I don't know why they had the different names. Like, I would have been fine myself, but I guess maybe some people just wanted a different name with Big Boss. Like,
well, you weren't around for them to get clarification back then, right?
No.
But... this was his first film with Golden Harvest and Raymond Chow, right? This
right.
is after after his run with Green Hornet when they signed him on for a 3-picture deal, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, right on.
And then he actually jumped in the Way of the Dragon. He actually ends up creating his own production company with Raymond Chow.
That's right.
So it was Concord Productions Incorporated. So.
Yeah, so The Big Boss was... a big smash hit over there.
I think the titles were, if I recall correctly, I think it was the U.S. versions when they were canning them, stuff like that. They called them something different, I guess, for the U.S. market, I believe, kind of get people involved in it and that sort of thing. So,
well, it shows here, like, I guess the U.S. one was 1972, so like a year later.
Yeah.
It's if you guys ever get a chance to see the posters for the different ones. So Big Boss, and then they did a different poster, obviously, for like the U.S. market or North American market.
Mm-hmm. So as Fist of Fury, they had a separate poster?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
It actually has like Bruce Lee in his typical pose, like kind of like a jump kick.
Right.
But no, it's actually pretty cool. Actually, it's funny. I haven't seen the movies in so long. It's one of those things where I could watch them over and over with. Like I remember. With Way of the Dragon, which is... Unfortunately, I apologize, guys. I didn't catch the other two movies.
Fine.
I know I had them, and out of the two movie rental stores, none of them had it.
See, I had no problem. I own them all. I have them all on VHS. I have them all on DVD. You know, I'm not going to miss out on them. But
yeah,
it was,
exactly.
Yeah, it's... It was pretty exciting. Like, oh,
it was
yeah.
nice to actually go back, and I hadn't seen them in years. It was nice to go back and actually watch them again. Because I remember seeing them as a kid and how I remember it. And you go back and you see it again, and you're like, as an adult, you see it like really different now. And because I take...
Oh, for sure.
Yeah, for me, because I take martial arts and I actually took Jeet Kune Do, it was now I start seeing things that I studied that he's actually starting to portray on screen. And if you watch them from Big Boss through to Way of the Dragon, and then later Enter the Dragon, which we'll do another time, you can actually see his progression. The style, and how he started incorporating his philosophies into his films as well. A lot being done in his fight scenes.
So a lot of... I took the book out that he wrote about Jeet Kune Do from the library one time. I'm going to get myself a copy of it to keep and actually really review. But
that'd be the Tao Jeet Kune Do you're talking about? Yeah.
Yeah. one of the big things that he always talked about was limit your fixed positions. And like you said, where you see the progression throughout the movies, when you go from the big boss, where that was, you know, kind of almost at the height of his career, is when everything really kind of picked up for him. Yeah, you see a lot more of those fixed positions, like you said, and then as he progresses on, you really see how it goes from, well, his philosophy about water, you know, flowing.
Right.
You really see that through the movies, where by the time he's beaten up Chuck Norris in Way of the Dragon, you know, he's so fluid. There is no rigidity with his movement whatsoever. He's not locked into anything. It's just everything almost seems effortless and more natural, almost like a style without a style.
Right.
It's really nice.
He's moving very cat-like and very reactive to what, you know, his opponent's doing. He's always, like, intercepting him at any beat. And what I thought was interesting, as you mentioned, was in his earlier stuff, like the big boss we're talking, I think it was more or less stylized kung fu stuff that he was, a lot of the fight scenes. It really wasn't him at the beginning, that sort of thing. The way he was doing some of the stuff, it was a lot of, you know, a lot of kicking, I find, throughout. And then once he hit Way of the Dragon, there was less kicking, more hand work and stuff like that.
A little bit more acrobatics.
Yeah, a lot at the beginning, there's flips he does and stuff like that, which you wouldn't see in anything that he actually, you know, ends up taking control over, I guess you could say, or putting his stamp on it. So it was kind of interesting to see, you know, that happening, and then later on become more of his stamp on it, I'd like to say, right?
Yeah.
Because he started putting his own creativity in it and that sort of thing. So, yeah, it was at the beginning, it's just a lot of that stylized kung fu kind of punching basically and kicking and, you know,
fighting for the camera, basically.
Right, yeah. Oh, here's a trampoline shot. He's bouncing and, you know, but it doesn't look like he's on a trampoline. He's supposed to be flipping over, you know, something. Like, I think one of the scenes, there's some dogs attacking him. He's bouncing around and I'm like, okay, you know.
Yeah, that's more towards
the end of the film. Yeah.
When he's exactly. Having his final battle with the big boss.
Yeah.
Which I'm sure, you know, every video gamer out there, you get to the end of a level and you're fighting the boss.
That's right.
I'm sure that this movie had an impact on that, because this movie goes through basically a gauntlet. It's, you know, from start to finish, he's facing different little challenges all the way throughout until he gets to the end and he fights the big boss. And, you know, he has to take out the boss in typical gaming fashion, which really didn't exist back then.
Right, exactly.
I'm sure that that movie had an impact on how we play video games nowadays. It's just my theory on things.
So, Ryan, so what's the premise of this movie, anyway?
Bruce Lee plays a character, I guess, Chang, who's actually from mainland China, who goes to Thailand to live with his uncle. I guess there's some issues with, in their ice factory.
Yeah.
I guess a block of ice breaks, and they find, I guess, white powder.
Yeah, Bruce is the one that actually throws the, he's supposed to come over and he helps this guy push it, except he puts his whole body into it and blasts it through. And
then they see, obviously, the white substance. I still think it's white sugar.
Yeah.
It could also be cocaine. We're not quite sure.
It's in a bag. It's protected. No one really cuts it open and sniffs it or tastes it, so
yeah.
We don't know what it is, technically.
But, yeah, it's that whole he didn't know his own strength kind of thing.
He was just trying
to do it at all.
Yeah.
And that's how it busts apart completely by accident.
The rail, you know, all the ones before were okay, but the one he pushes all of a sudden had a little bit too much zing and hits the rail and breaks through.
A little bit too much Bruce in it.
Yeah. So I said, just power through the hips, so.
Well, part of the movie, I guess, the other cousins get sent to, I guess, but they got killed for asking too many questions.
Yeah.
And then I guess apparently here, what you guys were saying, obviously, like the big boss scene, but I guess the boss's son gets killed in the process. Spoiler.
Yeah, spoiler for a movie that's 40 years old.
I haven't seen it.
But because it's been so long since I've seen it, when did they start doing, like, Bruce Lee's, the trademark, like the...
That starts in the next film.
So they didn't do that in this one.
No,
there's hints of it.
Yeah.
Everything he did in his career had, like, and this goes back to when he was a child in some of his father's films and stuff like that, because his father was a performer as well, where you see the thumbing of the nose and certain fluidity with his body.
Okay.
That stuff goes right back to childhood and his just desire to entertain. But like Jody says, you really don't see him come out until the second film because of his partnership with Raymond Chow. Where he launches his own production company, where he's working on the scripts, he's working on the choreography. So a lot more Bruce gets in there. Whereas the big boss was Raymond Chow came to him, this is my script.
Yeah.
We want you to do it. And he just kind of jumps on board as an actor. And it was his work in that that really blew up in China with, like, audiences had no idea what to expect and were so pleasantly surprised with this, they went nuts for him. And that's where all of a sudden they just said, okay, now we're going to give you more creativity and more places to just have your outlet.
Yeah.
You do what you want. And that's where we got more of a progression from there.
Well, it's funny that you said that. Like, I guess the film was written for, I guess, another actor, James Tin.
Yep.
I don't know if I pronounced that right. Yeah. But I guess Lee's performance was so, like, overwhelming. Like, he did really well. But I guess that's what one of the first films that made him famous across Asia, right? So
yeah. Yeah, it was, he had done Green Hornet in the States.
Yeah, and, I remember that.
You know, that's, it was right around that time when that show ended that his father passed away, and he returned to China, and Raymond Chow met up with him while he was in China and said, you know, you did Green Hornet over there, it's just a minor role in the States, because, you know, Chinese still weren't quite accepted back then, believe it or not, in the 70s, it's, you know, you still got that segregation, but over in China, Green Hornet was huge. Because he had been the first...
Not just Green Hornet. No, it was Kato. Because they called it the Kato Show. Yeah.
Because Green Hornet didn't matter. It was the first... Yeah. I think it was the first real Chinese actor to play a major part in a television series in the States.
Yeah.
Where he actually was an important character. And it wasn't a white guy playing a Chinese. It was a Chinese playing a Chinese, speaking his own lines. He wasn't dubbed over. And he actually got to be himself. So it was just huge over there. He already had a big fan base, and Raymond Chow just said, you know, we need to put you in movies because you've got fans here. And that's, you know, that sealed the deal. He was staying there. He was going to do these movies. And then, like, every step of the game, they give him something to work on, you know, like the big boss. They bring him in on that, blows the other guy away. And all of a sudden it was a, oh, my God, look what you just did. Here, let's get you to do another one. Let's do this now.
Yeah, because if you watch that, excuse me, if you watch that movie, you can tell how much more energetic and outstanding Bruce is compared to the other actors.
Yep.
And the funny thing is, a lot of those actors he plays with in The Big Boss follow him through to the next two films as well.
Yeah, there's a lot of
there's a lot of continuity, and you can tell like who he's friends with and what was working well.
Yep.
And I think there are also Shaw Brothers actors too that came with Raymond.
And I think Nora Mao, she was in all three.
She's on three. And she's actually the only female to actually kiss Bruce on screen. And that was in Fist of Fury.
Yeah. She was also, much to her credit, she was, I think, one of the first female actresses to have a contract deal with Golden Harvest.
That's right, yeah.
When nobody else was getting them.
Yeah, she was one of the most highly successful Asian actresses at the time.
And I think she was also where he was when he took the pain meds that...
That's right. Yeah, she was...
Sadly ended.
He was at her place. Life. Yeah.
Yeah, they were very good friends. There was rumors about everything else, but, you know, bottom line is they were friends.
Yep, exactly.
But, yeah, she had quite an impressive career herself, and I think... I don't know if it's still going on, but for some time she had a radio show based out of Toronto, even though she lives in...
well, that's cool. China. No, that I didn't know.
But, yeah, there was... It was really, that one thing that I really like with The Big Boss and Fist of Fury and The Way of the Dragon is that you do see these same actors kind of appearing.
Just different characters.
Yeah, contract players with the studio who actually you get to see a little bit of their own range.
Yes.
You know, we see American actors all the time. We see their range of different characters. A lot of time there's not much range. They're just a big name.
Yeah.
But then you get those really talented ones. And I think that's what I really liked about these Chinese actors, you really got to see a big range with the characters they played over these three movies. You know, they might have played a similar role, but played it so differently. It was I can buy right into this. No problem.
Yeah, exactly. Because even though their faces look the same, their characters are totally different, and you actually, like you say, you bought into it each film. Like
the body language was completely different. It was great. It made it easier to feel that it was an acting family that was really there to produce a great film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they did.
Yeah, they did a good job. A lot of the stuff I thought was funny, because based in the 70s, was the soundtracks. I think the soundtrack got better by the time it hit Way of the Dragon. But the first two films, I'm just shaking my head going, wow, this is really bad music.
Well, I thought Way of the Dragon still kind of sounded like the 70s porn, so I don't know if they could, the first two movies were any more
they were worse than that.
Every movie in the 70s sounded like 70s porn. All the music from back then was made with all the same instruments. It was a, hey, we've got this new instrument, this is the new sound it makes, and as soon as that happens, everybody uses it. Just like nowadays, you know, everybody's doing this recording stuff, and, you know, now it's in every piece of music. So, I enjoyed the music. I love it. I love listening to it when I'm watching movies.
There's something wrong with you, John.
That's why I'm the meatball. Okay, so, you know, it's great to chat about this. We'll chat about this a little bit more. Why don't we take a little bit break and be right back with y'all.
Hi-ya! And now, a word from our sponsors.
Face front, true believers. John Ballmer is an independent artist and illustrator. He has contributed to several indie comics published by Alterna Comics and more, and is able to draw in many styles and genres. John also does commission work in sizes ranging from 3x5 inches to 11x17 inches and even larger. Add some original art to your personal collection or surprise someone with a drawing just for them. Check out his work at drawnbyjohn.com and his Facebook group, Drawn by John, The Art of John J.C. Ballmer.
All right, welcome back, guys. So we were just talking about The Big Boss, and right now it's one of those cases where we'll kind of talk about what's kind of unique about this film and what it did at the box office.
Well, I know what you're saying as far as uniqueness. I guess the film had a little bit more of a, like, I guess an R rating due to what they had, like more violence. Apparently, in the original, I guess the Mandarin cut, I guess they had scenes, I guess, that had to be censored for extreme violence. Apparently, I guess, you guys, I don't know if you guys, which versions you saw, but I guess there was a graphic scene of a body being cut in half with a circular saw, an artery cut with a knife. And I guess it was supposed to spew from someone's forehead. And I guess
the one guy gets a saw, I think.
Yeah, and there's supposed to be like a vertical partial cranial laceration.
Yeah, I think it's the big saw from the the ice factory.
Yeah.
I have not seen those cuts. I've only seen the American cuts because that's what's readily available, right?
But, yeah. Well, yeah, I guess it was due. I guess the reason it was removed, or as they say, a censorship crackdown, was, I guess, 1972 Hong Kong movie. They did that to a lot of the films. Yeah, so, truth be told, it'd be interesting to see, though, just how. Because if you look at special effects, like, every movie, doesn't matter if it's drama, that always has a special effect. So, I'd be curious to see how they would have played that up.
Yeah, because this one, the blood was very poorly done. It looked like paint, more or less anything, so.
Well, any of the movies in that time frame really kind of looked like that. Like, yeah. Even the James Bond movies from that time frame, it was you could see that somebody put their hand on something and the blood,
then blood squirted out. Yeah.
So it was all pretty much like that back in that time frame, but that's what they had to work with, certainly with budgets and materials.
Of his three films that we're reviewing, I think this one, to me, was kind of like one of the most bloodiest and violent ones of the bunch that he's had. Like you're saying, you know, there's a sawing up people in half, in which they get iced and put into the ice and later discovered, and, you know, the cuts and lacerations and, you know, hacks to the head and that sort of thing. So at the time, being 71, it was pretty violent for its point. So they had to kind of tone back some of the stuff, do some editing, take some, you know, violent scenes out and that sort of thing, just to give it a rating where they can get it out in the theaters.
Yeah.
Right.
So. Well, I guess that's also to put up so they can make their money back. Like, I guess in Hong Kong, it actually made the most. Like, so 3.1 mil. When you look at it back then, that's quite a bit of money there. And I guess in North America, it made about 2.8.
Wow.
That's through the rentals, close. Which is still pretty good. Like, you got to figure for those kind of films, because you got to figure martial arts films was like 60s, starting out in the 60s. Because I still remember the old cheesy, where you see the old, like, the Mandarin-type characters with, like,
the long mustache.
Fu Manchu.
The stereotypical kind of Chinese Americans perceive them. Yeah.
But that's still pretty good for the box office, so I'd be curious to see how the movies compared.
Right, it was actually one of the highest-grossing films in Hong Kong history up to that point.
Yeah.
Then he did Fist of Fury, which blew it out of the water. Interesting point. I'll go into my fun facts. So one of the things I have for this is that Both The Big Boss and Fist of Fury were directed by a famous Hong Kong director named Lo Wai. And he's the guy who started Bruce Lee, getting him out into the Chinese public, making him famous. And
now, Lo Wai actually had a role in Fist of Fury. He was the inspector.
Oh, right.
That was him. So that was cool. In the movie.
He's doing a Hitchcock.
I completely didn't realize that until just now.
That is impressive, yes. The other thing was that Jackie Chan actually, this is his first film with Bruce, where he doubled for the Asian fellow Suzuki, or the Japanese fellow Suzuki. And he gets kicked in the throat. Bruce, they both kind of fly in the air, and Bruce does a sidekick, catches him in the throat, and blasts him through the paper windows, I guess you could call it. So that was kind of his first big fight scene. And this is the start of where Bruce choreographed his own fights.
Right.
And then the other fight scenes were done by another director. And it kind of happens in the next film as well.
Yeah, and he had a series of doubles in Fist of Fury who had a similar body type or could move in a similar fashion, just to take some of the workload off of Bruce. Like, he did as much of his own stuff as he could, but when he could be sitting back, kind of reviewing some footage or something like that, he would have somebody else step in and, you know, take a punch or take a shot from a different angle, which is... It actually brings up a point with something you just talked about with The Big Boss, how violent that was.
Right.
Well, again, like we talked about, that's a movie where Bruce was just kind of brought in as the actor.
Right, yes.
And...
Because they really didn't have too much say into this one.
With Fist of Fury, where he did have more say, you really see the violence come down and more of the art of it
come out.
So the blood and guts are gone. But very much the styles, the movement, the fluidity, that really starts to come into play with Fist of Fury.
Right.
Also known as the Chinese Connection.
Yeah, so as John was saying... it is, yeah, the U.S. version is known as Chinese Connection. Now, this movie was set in 72. It was made in 72, I should say. The first one was actually set, Big Boss was set in Bangkok, Thailand. This one here is set in Shanghai, China, around the 1900s at the time. So there's a lot of tension between the Japanese and Chinese, since the Japanese invaded them in World War II and that sort of thing. So this kind of... movies based around that. He plays a fellow named Chen Zhen, which, like you and I were talking earlier, was an actual famous martial arts fellow from China at the time.
It was his teacher, the teacher who passes away, who I think is the more famous person from Chinese history, Ho Yinja.
Oh, okay.
Who...
Right, because he loses his teacher in this one, and that's where he comes back.
And that's
back.
What triggers the...
What triggers the whole Fist of Fury.
In actual Chinese history, it's the Japanese who were actually responsible for Ho Yinja's death.
Right.
In an exhibition fight between him and a Japanese. And if you want more details about that actual story, which happened in history, Jet Li did a movie. The name of it is escaping me right now, which is insane because I watch it all the time too. But Jet Li actually played Ho Yinja in a film that was about his life leading up to that fight and that actual person in history's death.
Mm-hmm.
Then this movie kind of picks up, funny enough, so many years before, right after that, the master's death. And this is, Bruce Lee plays one of his students who just takes it the wrong way and really kind of launches the retaliation against the Japanese school,
right,
who they believe are responsible. So
he's because he comes back from wherever he was, and his teacher's dead, so he's overcome with grief, and then through course of events, he finds out later that he was actually poisoned through biscuits that he had eaten, and the Japanese are actually to blame for it.
Right.
So there's this whole my school is going to battle your school because you killed my teacher, so we got to kill your teacher type of tit tat for tat kind of thing that slowly develops throughout the film.
Yeah, and that happened a lot back then. It was, there were so many martial arts schools. They were all rivals.
Yeah.
I'm better than you. You're better than this guy. And they were always bickering and fighting. And then when you have situations where, like you said, the Japanese came in and really took over these certain areas of China,
mm-hmm.
During the World War II, they had a lot of pull and a lot of sway in that area, even though it wasn't even their turf. So there was these small little rebellions that would kind of come up from other schools.
Yeah.
And, you know, this was just a great example of the kind of things that may have actually happened. We don't really have all kinds of confirmation on it, but I'm sure stuff like this did happen.
Oh, yeah. It's funny that you said that, because Jody and I, a few months ago, watched It Man, and watching those films, which we got to talk about that.
Did you just watch the first one or the second?
We've watched both.
Oh,
man. We'll bring you in on that one. Like, yeah. Because you guys were talking about the different schools, and it's funny seeing that they're all in competition, and each master was, well, we're better than you type of thing. So
my style's better than yours.
It's going to be interesting to see once we actually get a chance to talk about those films, because I loved it. As soon as Jody told me about those ones,
yeah,
right on Netflix, and I rented it.
We have to review those together. Oh, yeah. Donnie Yen is another one of my favorites.
Oh, an amazing actor.
There's a movie where him and Jet Li actually face off, which we're going to have to review as well.
Sure.
But
that'll be down the road, so we get
there's also a Bruce Lee tie-in with the Ip Man movies as well. But
yeah.
Yeah, we'll definitely get on those.
For sure.
Yeah, in this particular one, in Fist of Fury, it's the Hoyunja school was the Jingwu Sports Federation that he started to kind of bring people together and learn martial arts in this way and have the right philosophy, kind of what Bruce went on to do with his own schools. But yeah, this in this particular movie, he's a student at this school. And yeah,
It's kind of like the I think in this film was more or less the Japanese had their style, which was karate, and then the Chinese had kung fu at the time, right? So it was like that style versus, you know, yeah, exactly. Right? So in this case, it was a school versus school or a style versus style or even like, you know, ethnics, right? You know, Chinese versus your Japanese,
very much
right?
A race
so there's a lot of like those.
A lot of tension.
Yeah, a lot of tension was built up. And Bruce doesn't believe his teacher's dead, and the Japanese come in, and they deliver a sign. Now, this is kind of like a big, big moment, too, where it says, sick man of East Asia, and they give it to him. And at first you think it's a nice gift, and then they can't read it, and they're like, what's this say? And then the interpreter actually explains it. Now, the interpreter's funny because he actually shows up in Way of the Dragon as well.
Yeah, again,
right,
completely
as
different
totally
role.
Different, totally different role.
But completely biased.
Great acting, and it's pretty funny, that one. So they give him the sign, and that triggers the kind of feud between the two schools. And you can tell, I love it because they're doing lots of close-ups on Bruce, and he's standing there with his clenched fist, and he looks like a freaking time bomb, just ready to blow, like any second, like just boom, and he's off, right? But
I know exactly what scene you're talking
about.
Yeah,
they keep him kind of back, and they're holding him. He's like, no, just stay calm, you know? We all want to fight these guys, but we're not going to.
The funny thing is, if you look at Bruce in that scene, and you're focused on his face, you don't see half of what he's doing. All of his acting was in his body in that series of scenes around that point.
He tries to do it through his face, and like you say, there's a lot of the Bruce trademarks, you know, rubbing of the thumb on the nose, and even the wham, a guy takes a shot, and he's got blood in his mouth, and he spits it out, and then he does that in a couple films as well, and you're like, oh, here he goes, right? He's snapping now. He's taking this guy right out. So in this one, as you were, Ryan was mentioning, this is like the first movie where really you start hearing his Kiai sounds and that Bruce Lee trademark, starts coming out. This film's also the first one where he, uses nunchucks first time on screen.
Yep.
So, that's important because their, staple fight scene in this movie was the big challenge where Bruce takes the sign, goes over to the Japanese school and ends up because the one fellow says, well, if anyone can beat us, I'll eat my words. So he takes it over and hands it back to them, and he challenges everyone in the room. So all of a sudden there's this giant one person versus, like, you know, 20 guys.
Typical Bruce.
Yeah, and he's like, I'm not just taking one. I'm taking the whole freaking room because I'm that good, right? And he ends up fighting them all, and he beats them all because of the nunchucks mainly. He starts slamming them. Right. So he's whipping these things, and it was like art. It was amazingly beautiful how the nunchucks were actually something that Dan Inosanto gave him and talked to him about and showed him a few moves, and Bruce took it like from there. And he ended up like putting it into obviously three of his movies, the third one being the scenes he filmed before he died, which was Game of Death.
Yeah. And important to note with Inosanto, he was one of Bruce's students in his schools in America.
Yeah. So yeah. Dan Indosanto, we mentioned it in the first segment of the Martial Arts Edition, where Dan Indosanto was actually a student of Bruce's and ended up now being the founder of the Jeet Kune Do Society, and he's the one that's carried on the legacy and leading it. So a lot of responsibility there. But yeah, he first introduced Bruce to the nunchucks, so that was cool to see. And this is the first time you see, when he does the fight scene, he actually takes off his shirt. So if you look in The Big Boss and you check his physique then and you check his physique now, you can tell he's a little bit more chiseled from the two. He's a little softer in the first one. He's a little more hard-edged than the next one.
Far more focus on his body.
Yeah, he's now working a fitness routine. He's definitely, you know, every muscle is created for the exact
for specific purpose.
Yeah, that's the word.
And like you said, he was developing his style at this time,
right.
So he had more focus on his movement, his balance, and everything like that. So it obviously had an effect on his physique as well.
Right, exactly. And just before we go, that fight sequence with the seven people, he does it in one take in the one scene where he's doing his kicks, and he's kicking, like, 7-8 guys in, like, one shot. It's like, boom, 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 boom. And that was all done in one take. And that's pretty impressive.
Yeah,
so.
And then the nice thing is he actually gets that guy who said he was going to eat his words, and he shoves the poster right
actually,
in
actually, both
mouth.
Of them, yeah. The two guys end up eating the words before he leaves. So that's,
all right.
We'll end it there.
Yeah, we'll take a quick break, and we'll talk a little bit more about Fist of Fury when we come back.
Stay tuned, loyal listeners. There's more We Got the Geek still to come.
Sketchbook Comics and Games is a store that has something awesome for everyone. In addition to selling comics, board games, and action figures, there are tables for open gaming. Wednesday nights, Sketchbook features game night starting at 6 p.m. Friday through Sunday, Sketchbook is the place to be for Magic the Gathering. The store is located at 224 Glenridge Avenue, Unit 9 in St. Catharines. Come on down for all your geek comic book needs.
All right, so welcome back, guys. So we're in discussions of Fist of Fury at this point. One thing I liked about this film was that Bruce actually had a chance to play some disguises in the film.
Yeah.
Right? So he was like a rickshaw driver, telephone repair technician, and that was hilarious because he's really geeky, big glasses. Kind of lowers his posture.
And the best part
about
that, is he turns that on, on camera.
Right.
So you actually see him slip into that character.
That's
and
right.
You see his kind of development of it.
Yeah. And he plays this old paper man. Ryan, you were talking about Fu Manchu look. This is exactly what he was playing off. And he was kind of outside the Japanese club.
Right outside the Japanese school.
Selling papers and that sort of thing. And that's when Liu Y comes out, you're saying.
And he sells in
the newspaper. Yeah. So that was kind of cool. So I kind of liked... the fact that he got into characters and stuff like that.
Like the humor. Like, he definitely had a humor.
Because
I saw that in, like, Way of the Dragon.
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So, this is kind of like a prequel to that. You get to... He never really got to do too much, but he got to throw in a little bit of his humor and stuff like that, because he liked to play off of that.
And the nice thing was it all served a purpose. Like, he wasn't just slipping into these characters for the sake of doing it, just sake of showing that he could do it. It was that each time it was specifically so he could spy on the Japanese and plan his next move.
Yeah.
So there was very much a progression or development of his plot of what he's planning to do to get his revenge for his teacher's death. So every time he's always, you know, just kind of listening in or watching what those Japanese have got going or planning against his school, the Jingwu school, and
he can help them out, right?
Plays it all up to his favor, especially the rickshaw driver.
The rickshaw,
he takes care of the interpreter.
I loved that.
I kind
of wonder about that if it was something he actually did, if he was able to, because he's very strong, like freakishly strong. So it was interesting to see if he could actually, like, with support, lift that guy up in the rickshaw, just the way, you know, it was done.
It's kind of hard
was,
to think.
You know, oh, we got some wires.
Were there some wires there or not?
Yeah,
and
exactly.
Agreed, the guy was phenomenally strong, certainly for his size.
Yeah.
But the interpreter guy, okay, we'd say
he's not too heavy looking either.
He was very skinny, but he was very tall.
Right.
So he might have been maybe... I would say he was probably about 120 to 130 pounds.
I don't know about being tall, though. I think he was probably...
For a Chinese, he was pretty tall. He was tall.
I thought he was around Bruce's height. Like,
I think he was a little bit more.
A little bit taller,
The rickshaw you would think probably weighs maybe
wasn't much,
50 to 80 pounds. So could he have, with that kind of angle that he was lifting it at,
right,
could he have lifted possibly 200 like, pounds or more?
That was a full-on shot. It was no cutaway at that point when he started lifting him up.
Yeah,
so
you don't see the cutaway until he turns.
Until he turns floor. And he throws it like it's, you know, paper.
So it to me, my thought is that there was wires.
Right.
Not to take away from him, but simply because of the fact that it was completely effortless. If you actually watch his legs in that scene, his legs don't move, his feet don't change position. So I don't think
he does have
supporting it.
Yeah, he does have his 1 foot back in the way that he'd be pulling his weight back and you know, anchoring himself and enough to kind of lift it. But
I don't think it was just pushes it down.
Right. I don't think it was like fully done without some wires or some kind of assistance.
Still, looks good.
It looks amazing.
Yeah. You certainly can't see any wires.
Right.
Which, you know, it was a time frame where they would have had more difficulty hiding them.
Yes. Now, are you talking about like when he's sort of standing and is like,
he's holding up the rickshaw with the interpreter in it, and he just kind of lifts up the bars.
And you can see it's just the forearms rippling because he's like holding up so much. So I think there was like a little bit of
assistance. That just now it's like, do you see? Because normally movies back then you would still see.
Yeah, and it's hard
to say.
Bit of like, wires. It's a testament to his acting ability to really put his body into a position where it's believable.
Yeah.
So you can really kind of get into it and buy into it. But the question is just physics wise, does he position himself right to do it? That's what you don't know.
Right, yeah.
So I personally don't think he did it, or at least did all
of
it.
So it's the physics we're kind of talking about here. Like, was it possible that he could do it, knowing he's very strong?
It's Bruce Lee, man, of course.
I know.
The buy-in is
we're trying to separate the myth from the legend.
It really is believable that he's doing it, but it's, you know, a more advanced audience, say, from back then with our knowledge of movies and physics and stuff like that.
Yeah. But it's interesting.
Yeah, it's a really cool sequence.
So if you get a chance, Ryan, it's a really good scene.
Well, I still will go back to watch the first two movies.
Yep.
All of his movies.
And, you know, I hated the interpreter, so I loved it.
Yeah.
That was his time.
Yeah. And he ends up, I think, just wailing in on him. I think that's how he killed him, if I'm not mistaken.
When he threw the rickshaw, the interpreter hits his head on the wall and gets banged up pretty bad there. And then When Bruce turns his back, he picks up a rock to hit
him. That's right.
And then Bruce just, turns around and lays right into him and just... I don't think you see him stop hitting him. He just keeps hitting him. And then the scene cuts, and the next thing you see is the interpreter's hanging dead from a telephone pole.
Right.
He polished him right
off.
So
Bruce is actually systematically nailing these guys, and then he would hang them, through their bodies on ropes on the pole, kind of saying,
in public places.
In public places where everyone can see.
And kind of send them after you type of thing.
Because he does the disguises, to hide. Like John was saying, to spy for one, but he's also on the run. So he's hiding out, and this helps him kind of stay hidden and do his spy. Kind of getting more information on what's going on.
Just trying to avoid arrest because they know he's responsible for some murders of these Japanese because he's just taking the retaliation week.
So it was like, we kill them, they kill us. So at the end, it comes down to the Japanese slaughter a lot of the people in the Chinese club. And Bruce comes back and he sees this and they wanted to hand him over and he's got to give up. So at the end, they were saying that he's a coward and he should show up and this sort of thing. And he's snuck in the back door, so to speak, comes through one of the windows and they end up.
Well, he sneaks in the back door after he basically takes care of the Japanese school.
I'm kind of jumping ahead here. Yeah.
He completely finishes off the Japanese school, the leadership there, and the big Russian that they brought in.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Who he kind of spies on as he's the telephone repair guy.
Yeah.
Who's just a beast, driving nails with his bare hands and stuff.
But, bending iron bars around his forearm.
Bruce completely just wipes these guys out. He gives them, you know, the revenge is made. It's done. And he comes back to the school, like you said, just kind of hops in the back door. And then
So he comes in the back door and then he gives himself up. And he's trying to do it honorably, and then they walk him through the front door, and there's a firing squad of cops there.
Yeah, the Japanese constable has arranged
They've arranged that they're going to wipe him out, and it's all based on word of mouth, so to speak, that he did it. There was really no proof that he
There was never any real physical evidence or witnesses that he was the one responsible.
Right. So they were just framing him, so to speak. So at the end, he Ghost and decides, you know what, I'm going out in a big way. And he takes a running leap and a flying sidekick and segues, freezes there, and then you hear, like, gunshots and that sort of thing.
Gunshots and screams and stuff, yeah.
Yeah, so he took that from, actually, Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid, because that was one of his favorite films. So he actually...
Another great film.
Yeah. So he took that and added that in. What I find interesting, though, is, like, if that really happened... And they're firing at him. I'm thinking, you have people behind him on the steps. You've got, like, his colleagues, his students, his teachers, plus the Japanese.
And the inspector.
Consulate, the inspector. So you're wiping out a shitload of people just by trying to shoot this one guy.
And really, it wasn't until really recently that I paid attention to that. All the years I've been watching these movies.
Right, exactly.
He just gets so into the movement of what he's doing. Because in typical Bruce Lee fashion, there's a firing squad. What does he do? Tenses right up, gets angry, yells, and then runs at them. So you're so involved and hyped up in that mood and in that moment, you don't even think about the fact that there's people behind him. You think, oh, he's going at them. He's going out.
He's going down like a hero.
Blazing. Yeah. Yeah. And then it was one of those things where yesterday, rewatching this movie again after seeing it hundreds of times, I'm just thinking, what about all the people behind him?
Yeah.
So it was funny that you bring that up, because I never really paid attention to that before.
And I'm the same way on that, and that's what I was saying earlier, where it's like, as I watch these films, I start seeing different things about him.
I haven't, as much as I watch it. So to see that, it was kind of a surprise for me.
Yeah.
Wow, I never, ever looked at it that way before.
Going back, just a sec, the one on the big boss, there's also a confusing part where all of his cousins were killed, and Chow Main was kidnapped. That was the girl. And Bruce is sitting there, and he's thinking by the waterfalls, that little kind of waterfalls they had.
Right.
Remember? And he decides to help them out. And he decides, okay, I'm not leaving. I'm going to stay. I'm going to help out these people. And he throws this blue package into the water. And I'm thinking, well, what's the significance of doing that? What are you throwing away?
Yeah.
And what is in the package? So, like the firing squad saying, there's certain things like that that I'm seeing, that I'm picking up. I'm like, okay, what does this mean? What are these things? And I've never noticed it before, you know, because you're kind of in the moment and you're just going along with the film and watching it. But after a while of reviewing them and analyzing it, I'm thinking, okay, what's going on with that?
So now I'm going to have to go watch
it. Yeah,
boss,
look for that.
My first thought would be I'd probably pass it off thinking it was like a plane ticket or something like that.
Right, exactly. But it was a pretty big square package he throws in. It looks like a knapsack or something like that. I think he's like, screw it, I'm staying. And,
okay, yeah, I'll have to check it out. Maybe
check that out.
Or something.
The other part was with the big boss fight at the end. He throws his knife at him,
right,
and he kicks it and goes into the big boss. Then he runs in, and we're talking about the violence. He actually, in the U.S., he pushes it through, kind of, you know, into him.
Right.
But in the Chinese version, he actually does, like, a finger thrust along with the knife. So he's sitting there with his hands literally half impaled into this guy's rib cage.
Wow.
Yeah, and he's bubbling blood out from the inside, and you can see it kind of flowing over his hands and that sort of thing.
I could totally do that.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm kidding.
And that was one of those things. No, exactly, because I'm like, really? I don't think that's freaking possible.
Unless I think it is possible.
If the knife went through and he followed the wound in, then, you know, there's a greater chance.
I think if you kind of went on an angle and went between the ribs, I think a person could actually do that, but it would take a tremendous amount of force.
It does, yeah. And he was coming pretty square on him. And if he had long fingernails were sharpened, yeah, I think he could do that.
Hey, Ryan, stay on your best behavior. I've got an idea now.
So, yeah. So the fun facts on this film that we were kind of talking about during the break. One of them was that Liu Wei directed and wrote this film.
Yep.
And as you mentioned, it was Fokyun Gap, is that?
That's
what he said. Well, what I found online was that he was based on a famous Chinese martial artist, and that was his name.
Not a name that really stands out in history.
Right.
Or around the other characters that are portrayed in this movie.
Yeah.
I
don't know if you guys know this either. It was originally titled The School of Chivalry before they came out with Fist of Fury.
School of Chivalry.
Yeah, that was the script title at
that
the time.
Really doesn't, I don't think that ever could have worked.
No, it doesn't have pow to it or any punch to it.
Well, not only that, but I don't think chivalry really comes into play.
No, no, this is like a mass murders on both sides.
There's one point where he's in the cemetery where he's hiding out, and he says to the female character played by Nora Mao, that he specifically came back
make him his wife. That would be his wife, yeah, his girlfriend.
So that was the only chivalry that was anywhere in that movie at all.
Yeah, and that was the kissing scene at that point,
right,
too.
Right, so
that'd be
the
it.
School
yeah.
of chivalry.
Because there was no chivalry between them, too, because the two clubs were out to massacre each other. So, yeah. So, anyway. So
I actually like the Fist of Fury title for this one.
Yeah.
The Chinese Connection, I don't myself see it as fitting, but when you look at the States back in that time frame, well, it made sense to them.
Yeah, because but it was a segue to French Connection.
Yeah, they wanted it was a sort of play on that one, but you guys will probably be happy to know, I guess, now with all the North American releases, they've gone back to the original...
Although you,
title name, yeah. so which is good. Cool, as it should have been, right? So,
The budget for this one was 3 times higher than The Big Boss. So, obviously, you can tell, right? Yeah. There was a lot of nice production on it. The title was changed to The Intercepting Fist to cash in on Bruce's popularity. And then, obviously, that was changed later on.
And what Jeet Kune Do stands for is
Way of Intercepting Fist. Yeah, so that was kind of interesting.
Well, along with their budget, though, like, they've actually made a lot more, too, in the box office. Like, you got to figure from the last film, they made $4.4 million in Hong Kong.
So, like, another $1 million over the...
And then, for North American, about $3.4 million. So...
Wow.
And it just increases from there. I mean, we can talk about that for the next film.
And just to wrap this up, about the sign, there was also another sign that says, No Dogs or Chinese Allowed by Park.
Very,
big famous
very
scene,
big scene
there,
yeah.
Where he gets he kicks the scene and breaks it. But that was actually a real sign at the park at the time, or the Japanese consulate. I'm not too sure which.
Yeah,
I've heard
something like that.
Mixed reviews on it. So, and quickly about the Russian who Petrov, who his name was, that was by Bob Barker, and he was actually
Baker.
Sorry,
Baker,
thank you. Yeah, he was the first foreigner to have a major part in the Hong Kong film. At the time.
That I didn't know.
That was pretty cool. So, I thought that was kind of neat.
So, I guess we're going to take a... Did you have more
Just
there?
One more fact.
Okay.
Quickly. The other thing was, Fist of Fury was actually very influential since it caused a shift in Hong Kong cinema at the time. Because they were going from a lot of swordplay, a lot of empty hand fighting.
Right.
And which initiated what they call the golden era of kung fu cinema in the 70s, I would say. So... And that's my last little tidbit.
Oh, nice. Those were fun facts.
I'm glad you enjoyed them. Yeah.
So I guess we're going to take a little break, and then when we come back, we're going to go into...
Way of the Dragon.
The final of the three.
Yay, I watched that one.
Yay!
So we'll hear more Ryan.
Woohoo! All right, so we'll be right back.
Hiya.
Hold on, true believers. There's more We Got the Geek after these words.
Mostly Comics has been serving the Niagara region for over 30 years. The store sells a variety of comics and entertainment-related products, including graphic novels, toys, and collectibles. Mostly also purchases rare comics upon appraisal. Visit Kim and the Gang at 413 St. Paul Street in St. Catharines, or check out their website at www.mostlycomics.com.
And we're back. Again, we have in the studios our producer, Jay.
Hi.
Jody. And we got John. He's wanted to be part of our group for martial arts for some time now. So it's good having you guys again.
I am the meatball of the Intercepting Fist.
Yes.
The way of the Intercepting Meatball.
No, don't say Enter. Enter the Meatball. That's another movie title.
Oh,
that's,
right.
this one I get to chime up a little bit. Way of the Dragon. I actually thought it was quite funny. And, I mean, cheesy at the same time. Because you got to figure the film, again, is 1972. So obviously they made... quite a lot of movies.
Yeah, they made a couple.
In the North America release, I guess they called it Return of the Dragon.
And that was to capitalize on Enter the Dragon. It was supposed to be like a prequel. It was actually supposed to happen after.
Yeah.
But technically, it happened before Enter the Dragon. Mm-hmm. So.
Well, part of the plot, I guess, Bruce Lee's character, Tang Lung, is sent from Hong Kong to Rome, which is weird. Like, he... For you get a tip like typical Asian films, I always picture it's either going to be North America or in Asia. But I guess he gets sent to Rome to help Uncle Wang, I guess, in Nice, I guess, because I guess a Chinese restaurant is being targeted by the mafia. I have to admit, though, the mafia portrayed in the film.
Yeah, wow. It's really Italian.
That's pretty cheesy.
It was really like, bad. There's one dude that looks like Wolfman Jack. It's just really bad.
And obviously, you're sort of in somewhat your typical, you have like the mafia men sending people to kill Bruce Lee's character because he's fighting them off. That they call Chinese boxing.
Right, and they're trying to take over this restaurant.
Which I thought is funny, because they're training the waiters, because they don't have a lot of business, because they're being scared away. They're training Chinese boxing, like...
Yeah.
I thought that was too funny, yeah. And then obviously, Bruce Lee's character comes out, it's like, oh yeah, you don't like Chinese boxing, and then obviously he starts doing his thing, it's like, oh, okay. I actually like the movie. I mean, I like any of Bruce Lee's movies. And I've seen all these, but it's probably been 25 years since the last time I seen Way of the Dragon.
This is his first one. Like we were talking about, how there was a progression. So by the time he hits this one, he's got more control. Like John was saying about Raymond Chow. He gives him more money on his contract, and he actually creates his production company at this time, and he ends up having more control in the case of writing, directing, fight sequence, or choreography. So this is his baby. Personally, this one for me is my favorite. Basically, it's got a lot more humor. It's got more Bruce in it. I see a lot more... how he's more chiseled in this one. Yeah. And by Enter the Dragon, the guy's freaking ripped like crazy. But in this one, he's a lot more in control. So there's a lot more Bruce stamp on this film.
This movie was all personality.
Yeah, this is just, like, to me, aside from Enter, Enter's the big one for everybody. I like this one myself personally. And I really like Fist of Fury, which we just talked about. For a few things, a lot of the big fight scenes, and he has more choreography done in that film, and it was just a better storyline, I think, compared to the first one, Big Boss. So.
Yeah, like we mentioned a little bit earlier before we started the show today, Fist of Fury is actually my favorite out of the three.
Yep.
Just because I like the story a little bit more. To me, even though Bruce did an amazing job with Way of the Dragon, I found, to me, the script was a little bit on the cheesy side or a little bit on the corny side.
Okay.
So I didn't like the story quite as much for this one, even though it's a fantastic movie and I love the characters and the way the characters kind of go off against each other. The script, for me, was a little bit more campy. That's the way I found this.
Humor you found more campy. Okay.
I found the humor was just a little bit too much. I thought was more of a serious kind of situation.
Right, okay. It's kind of interesting you mentioned that, because you were talking earlier about his signature trademarks that he did as a kid. This film really brings those out.
It really does.
You can see a lot. Like the very beginning, he's standing there at the airport, and the old lady, I love the scene, the old lady is just eyeballing him and staring him. Like,
not looking away, just
focused right on him, like she's never seen a Chinese man before, and... Till her husband comes in and takes, like, even at that point, she's still focused. He's like, hello, dear, you know?
And all he's doing is just turning his head and smiling. Typical Bruce fashion. Hugging his luggage.
Yeah, he's kind of holding the bag, thinking he's going to get robbed or something. So.
Or the kid.
When he's
the kid with the ice cream.
Because
he's trying to find something to eat, but he doesn't speak the language.
That's right. And then I couldn't figure that out at the beginning. And then as he went into the place and tried to order, and it's all Italian,
because
he's in Rome, right? And then it's like he can't read, and then decides to order, and he just says egg. And then he starts pointing, right? Yeah. And then the lady brings out like five soups or whatever he was eating.
Yeah, he just points at just like points, five or six different things.
And he starts just inhaling them.
And he ate it all.
He did, which was impressive, and I think it blew away a lot of the people at the restaurant, too. Like, wow, this guy's packing it back for such a small guy. But he ends up paying for it because he keeps asking to go to the washroom.
Yeah, there's like two or three different times in that within a 10-minute time frame where he asks somebody to let him go to the toilet. Yeah,
where's your washroom?
That's what I was going to say. It's funny that you normally say, hey, where's your bathroom? It's like just toilet. I don't know.
Then he stands on the toilet and squats on it to yeah. go, which is typical.
Oh,
in
that's
China,
when
right?
he was in the restaurant.
Yeah,
and
the
person walks in, and then he shuts the door.
Yeah, which is, you know, it's
yeah, which is funny because that segues into like, you know, a big fight that they're like, hey, he was one of the bad guys. What'd you let him go for? And he feels really bad, so he sits there, and this is classical Bruce when he was a kid, because he sits there, he crosses his arms, and he starts doing the pout, right? Yeah. So, in his earlier films when he was a kid, when an adult was scolding him, like in the film The Orphan, he actually does that. And it's like, frame for frame, looks exactly the same. So
yeah,
it's kind of cool.
He really had signature aspects about him that went through, like, through his entire life. And you see it. Like, it's, he doesn't let that stuff go. That just,
well,
so
it's who he
part
is.
Of him, right?
Yeah, exactly.
I don't even think he knew he was doing it half the time.
Yeah. Yeah, going what you were saying about being in Rome and you thought it was kind of weird. If you look at all the three films here, he always plays an outsider in some way, shape, or form coming in. And so it's kind of interesting to see that progress along the way into this one where he's really outside of his genre. He's in a totally new city. He doesn't know the language. So he's got to try and adjust.
Foreigners are completely different than the foreigners you see in the other films.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, he's in Thailand. Yeah. Well, you know, the American market doesn't see that much of a difference between the Chinese and the Thai.
Right.
You know, you see in...
Because I thought it was in China, and then I did some research, and I'm like, oh, it's in Thailand. Okay.
Yeah,
I
did not know that. And then you've got the Japanese pitted against them. So we don't see that much of a separation there. So it was kind of nice to see much more contrast. I actually loved the setting of this movie. I thought that
it's
the
even
idea to put it in Rome and to have all the ruins there and everything's so contrasting what we've normally seen him in, but also what his character has ever seen.
Right.
I thought that just the scenery itself, I think the settings really played as much of a character as he did.
I think it plays out better if you watch the undubbed version where it's actually the Cantonese and then subtitled, because you really get a sense of, wow, he's really outside of his genre. Because he's speaking his normal language, trying to interpret, oh, wait, this is Italian, I can't even read it. So it comes off, I think, a little bit better in that regard.
Yeah, I've not seen it.
I would love to watch. Yeah, I would love to watch, like, seeing, like, in Cantonese.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
And then just seeing, like, the English actors, like, because sometimes their parts are dubbed in, like, the Cantonese or Mandarin, so...
Because even in the one scene, he's got a phone. He picks up the phone to call the number he's got on the card. And he's like, 3-5. And the operator's, I'm sorry, can you say that again? And he's like, ah, screw this. Boom. And he drops the phone, throws the card down, out the door he goes, right? And he's like, I'll just go there. It'll be easier.
Yeah, I really like that they chose to film it there. I thought it gave more good scenes. Again, it's the contrast that really made it stand out and made him feel to the audience like he really was a sheep in a different field.
Yeah, exactly. So there's a lot of good things, like I like I said, the humor in it,
just the gangsters or whatever in
the
club was so like, come on.
That's actually something that I really find funny, and this isn't just about this movie, but it's more about 70s movies in general, and even going into 60s movies. Your typical thug, and this, believe it or not, this even carried on into the 80s where you watch movies like Roadhouse and stuff like that.
Oh, yes.
If you actually look at the thugs and the bad guys, I look at these movies and I think, man, I could take this guy. Basically, if you're tall or you're heavy, you could be a thug.
Right, exactly. Which was typical in this film. They're
not
all...
like what we got into later 80s and into the 90s where bad guys were guys that looked bad. They looked tough. They were they
were fit.
You definitely would be intimidated walking up to them. Half the thugs in this movie that kind of cause all the trouble for the restaurant and for Bruce, you know, to me, they didn't seem like they were even remotely close to a challenge for Bruce. So he goes through them.
Like in the first fight scene with him, which is hilarious.
How did anybody not go through them? Because if one of those guys stood up in front of me and tried to give me a hard time, I'd be looking at them like, are you kidding me? Really?
Yeah,
you're the tough guy?
You can tell, since some of them come up to him and they're very intimidated already. So the Wolfman Jack looking dude, he's like, okay, get him. And he's like kind of pushing all these other guys, you know, ahead of him to attack. And
Well, he had already had his ass handed to him.
Yeah, they all had they all had their butts handed to him, and then they come back again for another round, right? So he's like all timid and pushing everyone else, and the one fellow, he's got a knife in his hand. He walks up, and you see him going, you know, gulping, like, oh, crap. You know, and Bruce has got two chucks this time, not just one. So, yeah. And he's like, oh, man. And then you hear, bop, 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 and down he goes.
Yeah, to me, I found, and again, this might be part of why the story was a little bit weaker for me in this one, was simply because the thugs were just not believable as thugs. Like, to me, they just seemed like my cousins. You know, they didn't seem tough. They just seemed like people that you would know or hang out with on the side, on the street, who might be cool, might be. I'm reaching for that one, but I didn't see toughness in them whatsoever.
Well, so I don't think it's like your typical mafia, like mafia, like thugs, right? Like I was thinking North American, like what you would see in like New York.
The mafia movies.
Yeah,
yeah, the role
or the mafia movies, right? Yeah. But
the only people who really came across as tough in this movie to me. Were Bruce,
three, yep,
Chuck Norris,
yep,
and that was it Japanese or the Korean fellow?
Korean fellow, Hwang Sik,
yeah, or Sheik. Those are really the only ones that seemed tough to me in this film.
And Bob Wall, he was the student to Chuck.
Yeah, I was just gonna say his apprentice or whatever.
Yeah, scar on his face.
Yeah, which he gets a scar in Enter the Dragon too. So I thought that was kind of funny when I saw that.
You know,
so those are the actually.
So there's four.
Yeah. So those are the three big stars. Chuck Norris being the sometime U.S. karate champ. You got Bob Wall, who plays his apprentice in this, but he's also a U.S. heavyweight champ in karate.
Yeah, two or three times there.
Yeah, and then the Korean fellow, Hwang In-chik, I think, hopefully I pronounced that right. He's a Korean Hapkido master. So,
yeah, he's way up there in his levels as
He's up there as well. So Bruce obviously had connections with these, you know, friends and stuff like that. Interesting fun fact about that, Chuck Norris was not originally the person to play Colt. It was actually another karate champion named Joe Lewis, who was a student of Bruce's for a bit, picking up a few things and being taught by Bruce. So he was originally written in the script for that. I'm not too sure why he couldn't make it or do it, but Chuck Norris ended up being it, which was a better call, I think.
Yeah, I watched so many documentaries, and I don't recall ever finding out why that would have happened, but yeah, very pleased that Chuck Norris stepped in there. You know, we got our introduction to what has now become, obviously, a legendary kind of actor
for sure.
Character, right?
Yeah.
You know, he's outlived it, the kind of persona that he is, right? So it's...
Yeah, this, really cool to have this film is actually one of the... I think there's only two where Chuck Norris actually plays a bad guy. It was this one as Colt, and then a really, really bad movie, totally B, that Lo Y did called Slaughter in San Francisco. Really bad. And he kept going at Bruce with it and wanted a Bruce star in it as well. And Bruce kept denying it. So if you see it on YouTube, you'll see why it's really bad. But yeah, that's kind of something that. I'm glad with this film because it was the big moment was in the Coliseum.
Yeah.
So this is the big fight scene between Chuck and Bruce. And as a fanboy, man, that was like something to see.
Now, before we get into the Coliseum, I think maybe we should take a quick break so we can come back refreshed on that.
Yes.
And then we'll talk about the Coliseum because that deserves
its own section. That's the pinnacle, so we'll go from there.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And now... A word from our sponsors.
Kristen Hunter is a Canadian artist specializing in polymer clay creations. Kristen is a geek at heart, and most of her creations are nerd-themed. She makes everything from Captain America earrings to video game-inspired necklaces and everything else in between. Check out Kristen's amazing work at www.wasabeads.com or visit her Facebook group, Wasabeads Custom Creations.
All right. Go ahead.
So we're
We're back. It takes three to do our welcome back intro.
Yeah.
We're going to finish up with Way of the Dragon. I have to admit, out of the three movies, which the first two I need to watch, I did enjoy Way of the Dragon.
Good. Yeah, this is actually one of his bigger ones. Like I say, it was my favorite, aside from Enter the Dragon. I'm just going to throw in some fun facts on this one, because we're going to segue into the Colosseum fight scene. So this is the last movie, actually, to be filmed in the actual Roman Colosseum, which was the big battle between Chuck and Bruce. And Bruce actually had Chuck put on some weight for this scene. So he put some weight on the scene so he could look either more impressive or less impressive. And I think he's, in the case of more dominating, he's a bigger fellow compared to Bruce, who's a smaller Asian fellow. And the other thing was I don't know if a lot of people know about this, but the whole film was shot actually without sound, which is really weird at the time. And they actually ended up looping everything in post-production, so the actors would come back in and redo.
Wow,
all the interesting. Yeah.
So I guess Chuck Norris never came back because he didn't have a line in the whole movie.
No, he just looked menacing, and so there was that. And another fun fact would be the Death Note that the Mafia give to Uncle Wang, and there's a slick in a coffin,
yeah,
right, with the cross on it. It was actually Bruce's writing on it.
Oh, really?
So if you watch it again, take a look for that. You can see it actually was his handwriting. So that's cool. That was kind of neat. His ex-wife, or his late wife, I should say, Linda Lee Caldwell, this is her favorite film as well of all the ones that he's done.
Oh, really?
I think probably because it's got more of a stamp of him on it. And this is one of those films where he doesn't fight for the first 30 minutes of the film.
Yeah, it took quite a while.
It took a while to build up.
Establishing his character in the location.
And then he starts off. And I mentioned about the Chuck Norris villain. It's the first Chinese film shot in Europe. And it features the double nunchucks on screen. Bruce is the first Chinese actor, like we mentioned, starting his own film. That was on this one. Or a production company, I should say, on this one. And I think it's the first Kung Fu film from the 70s to be set in more modern times. Because if you look back, a lot of them were set in
30s and 40s.
Yeah, in the past, the Ming dynasties, and, you know, that type of thing. So this is kind of cool that they kind of modernized it.
Yeah, it was really cool that it kind of fit in with the time frame that it was being played. And I think that also added to the contrast when you had something like the fight in the Colosseum,
mm-hmm.
where, you know it's in modern times, but it still has that kind of ancient...
Gladiator, exactly. You know, got two guys coming in the ring, and kind of like we have with UFC now, in a way.
Yeah, and that was really the feeling I got, where, you know, you've got these guys are the respective tough guys from their side, and now they're squaring off where the gladiators once squared off,
mm-hmm.
and they're going to go at it. And you're just like, yeah, I'm ready for this. You know, they're stretching and they're sizing themselves up.
Yeah,
you know,
and that's what I love.
Preparing themselves.
Yeah, they're warming up. So,
but there's also this like massive level of respect to let them do that.
Exactly, right? And they're warming up, so you know they know this is going to be a big battle between the two. I love the cat. I think the cat's very significant in it.
Yeah, I dig it.
It's you know, he's sitting there, and it's kind of a situation where he's almost the referee watching what's going on, and
the cat almost represents us.
Yes, as the viewer,
we're sitting there anticipating what's going on, and it was we're ready, and then they just go at it, and the cat is there watching the whole thing. Right?
Yeah, and the warm up I think also signifies the fact that, like the older Kung Fu films, you wouldn't see anything like that because Bruce doesn't pan away. It's like you saw like a lot of full screen shots of him doing what he did. So it wasn't an actor mimicking like the fight choreographer in the movements. It was actually a martial artist where he was like the real deal.
Bruce really preparing for a fight.
Right. And I think that really kind of also was historic in that case as well, making a whole change in the Kung Fu industry at that point where they started, you know, kind of more full screen shots and less editing and gimmicks and more, you know, dead on fight scenes and that sort of thing. So
one thing I really liked about this fight in particular, as we've talked about through the whole series of movies, is his fluidity is really at its peak mm-hmm. here. You know, I think we even see a little bit more of this than we do in again, this particular fight than we did in Enter the Dragon, in my opinion.
Okay.
Where
it's
obviously arguable, but
I'm going to disagree on this because I know where you're going.
I really like how we've got the fluidity where he's evolved to this stage where he's fighting the contrast, which is Chuck Norris, who's very stuck in fixed positions and rigid movement, and he doesn't have the flow at all. So you've got Bruce's adaptability and fluidity that just kind of comes out and obviously dominates. I really like the contrast and the fighting styles, which you really see more of a contrast here than you see in a lot of the other films.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll agree with you on that. You're right. And I think that with this one, though, it ends up being that, you know, Chuck kind of starts winning at the very beginning. And then Bruce starts adapting. So this is where his Jeet Kune Do kind of philosophy starts coming in. Because if you notice, he starts bouncing.
Yep.
Right? And he starts becoming great, more cat-like and reflect more aggressive.
Kind of where this is where his brains are starting to overtake the brawn,
right?
Basically.
Yeah. So like he's
getting beat up, and now, yeah.
Right. So now he starts using his he's like, okay, so I'm going to start changing my tactics. And then once he started changing the way he fought against Chuck, who was very rigid and couldn't and tried to adapt, he starts bouncing and ends up getting his face kicked a few times. So it ends up being that he couldn't quite get it or adapt it properly.
Yeah, he was too locked into his style.
Right. So this is a great scene because it shows that. It shows the Jeet Kune Do aspects of it about adapting to change and fluidity and water and going with it. You also see a lot of Bruce's trapping coming from his Wing Chun background.
Yep.
There's a tight scene where Chuck's throwing some punches, and Bruce is intercepting him, trapping him, and then blasting him.
A couple of shots right afterwards, yeah.
And one of the fun things is how hairy Chuck Norris is, and he grabs his chest hair, rips it out, and literally blows it through his hand.
Yeah, I don't know about you, but man, but if somebody ripped my chest hair out like that, I'd be like, okay, fight's over,
I'm done, you win.
Yeah, I'm good.
Yeah, so there was that kind of moment, which is also classical when it comes to mind about that fight scene.
And I'm pretty sure that thing there with the ripping of the hair, that was parodied in so many movies afterwards.
Yes.
Stuff like that.
Yeah.
Again, Bruce setting a precedent, which his legacy is obviously carried throughout. And everybody has these little tidbits to respect him in his films and you know, Chuck Norris as well.
Definitely.
Definitely very, very much a memorable scene, one of those ones that always stands out. You see that fight, and it's just like, yeah, that's why I watched this movie. This is what that led up to.
So at the end, he ends up defeating Chuck. He breaks his leg, breaks his arm, and you can tell Chuck's a warrior. Doesn't give up, stands up, tries to throw a kick, falls down. Bruce chokes him out, breaks his neck, end of battle. As honorable as it is, he puts on his gi, walks away, and sees Chuck's karate uniform there, his belt and his top. Takes it as a, you know, true respect to the warrior he just fought. Lays it down, puts the belt on him.
Yeah,
you know, kind of
just showing a little bit of
honorable and respect for, you know, who he just fought, even though he killed. And it's interesting because that's the only kill in the whole film that he actually kills someone.
That's
the
right.
Other guys,
the other movies are all full of deaths and stuff like this. And yeah, it's an interesting point. You don't really pay attention if you watch all of the movies in order.
Mm-hmm.
This one, yeah, that's the only person who dies in the whole movie.
In this film specifically, yeah.
Because
the other ones, they get beat up
and
knocked out. So it's kind of interesting to see that it's almost like 21 gun salute to a Marine, right? He just lays it out.
Gives a little bit more importance to the respect
of
the whole fight and
whatnot.
That makes it that much more important that was the only person who died in that film, and he died fighting.
Oh, right, for, you know, the warrior that he was. So, and then, how's it go after that? I think that's pretty close to, I think he wraps some tight ends up, and he pretty much leaves.
He has to go back to China.
Yeah.
And
he's like, okay, my job's done. Yeah, because Uncle Wang wants him back to China, so he's like, okay, I'm kind of done here. And
yeah, he doesn't want to leave them because he wants to stay with them. He, you know, he's kind of become a family with them.
Yeah.
But he knows that he can't really stay, and he needs to move on. And, you know, they kind of say at the end, no matter where he goes, he will always be alone.
Yes.
I think that's kind of like the last line of the
That's the very last line, yeah.
And
then just, it shows him walking away down the road with his knapsack.
But it's just kind of an ongoing theme. As you said, one of the themes is that he's always the outsider coming in.
Right.
But he's also always the outsider going out. So he never has a
He's home. Always the lone wolf, so to speak.
He's there to make his move and do what he's there for, and then he moves on.
Right.
And it's kind of funny that Bruce is always the lone wolf. Chuck Norris, in his film career, kind of did the same thing and actually played a character in Expendables 2 called the Lone Wolf.
The Lone Wolf, yeah.
But really, Chuck was always part of a team. He always had other people backing him up. Even with like Braddock and all those movies, he was never really alone.
Go Delta Force.
I think he was Lone Wolf McQuaid.
Lone Wolf and McQuaid.
Yeah, that's it.
So that was always a fun gag.
That's where the spoof was on that.
Yeah, I really liked the ending of this where it was, like you said, it's a lone coming in, it's a lone going out, pretty much all of them. But this one is where you get the most impact of it.
Right.
It was really exciting to just kind of have it end that way.
And
well, it was definitely a good choice. Jody mentioned the movies.
Did you want to mention the box office?
Just last tidbit, I guess. It went up to 5.3 in Hong Kong and worldwide. It didn't have a North American, but worldwide, $85
million. Wow.
That's huge. That's pretty impressive back then.
There's some movies now that don't make that.
No. Mm-hmm. Junkyard.
That's interesting because he actually, at the time, informed the press that he believed the film would make $5 million Hong Kong dollars, and they laughed at him. Obviously, in this case, who got the last laugh, right? So he proved them wrong. That's good.
Something he did throughout his entire life.
Right, exactly.
Well, definitely looking forward to our third edition. This is our second. Hope to bring many more. And John, again, man, you're welcome to be part of future editions.
If he's got Kung Fu, there's a pretty good chance I can show up.
But again, Jody, John, as well as our producer Jay, we'll see you next time.
Hi-ya!
Hi-ya!
Hi-ya.
Thanks for listening. To hear more We Got the Geek, check us out at www.wegotthegeek.com and on iTunes.